I'm Randy Mason, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. We've all seen it on TV. A hurricane strikes, leaving thousands without power, food, or clean water for days or even weeks. When disasters happen, the Red Cross is the organization that always seems to be there. This hour, we'll talk with a Red Cross liaison and two local volunteers who deployed to New York and New Jersey to help the victims of Superstorm Sandy last fall. Later, we'll explore the world of art forgery with an expert on the subject who's written a new novel about a museum heist. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When you think of natural disaster relief in hurricanes, floods, and that occasional superstorm, there's one charity that just always seems to be there, and that's the Red Cross. But what's it like to be there, setting up a shelter or feeding people who don't have anywhere else to go? And how do you get to be an expert in helping others recover from such a destructive event? We'll talk about it today here on Up to Date. I'm Randy Mason, in for Steve Kraske, and later in the hour, we'll get a look into the world of art forgery as well. But first, we're here to talk to a few of the people on the front lines when disaster strikes. Joanne Woody is a Red Cross government liaison who helps organize volunteers to deploy to disaster zones. Also joining us, we've got Jen Farmer, a Red Cross volunteer whose first disaster relief deployment was to Superstorm Sandy last fall. And Jim Petish, another Red Cross volunteer, also deployed to Sandy, veteran of floods, I think in Nashville and Minot, South Dakota. Right. Actually, that's North Dakota, right?
Right.
And you all obviously believe in this cause immensely, or you would not put yourselves on the front lines in the way that you have. You've also, I think, all been involved with Sandy, and I just can't resist starting there because it was such a landmark occasion. When you're in the middle of something like that, Jim, how chaotic is it to be, you know, the guy that everybody's looking to in that disaster zone?
Well, it can be extremely chaotic. It's one of those things that we base it on what experiences we've had in the past and the training we've received from the Red Cross. And we go forward from there, trying to help and assist the clients that we have as much as we possibly can.
What does that look like, though? I mean, you're on the ground, and people are terrified. You must see it in their eyes that they've never really probably been through anything like this before, whereas hopefully you have the right training. What's that like, folks?
Well, for me, I had no idea what to expect because this was actually my very first deployment.
Wow.
So when I first got to New York, I was actually sent upstate to Amsterdam, which is a small town. Hmm. And I was there pre-storm. So when the storm came through, we had set up a shelter. And actually, the town wasn't really affected. So we ended up closing that down. But then they said that there's a huge need down in Long Island. So again, I still didn't know what to expect when I got sent there. I walked into Nassau Community College, which was what we were using for the shelter, and there was just a sea of people. And it was just very humbling for me to see what we as volunteers can do at a time like that. So I thought it was, you know, just a very humbling and moving experience.
What can volunteers do? I mean, is it really the simplest, most basic things, or do you have to kind of assess each thing and custom as you go?
Well, in the Red Cross, when we work with our volunteers, our disaster responders, to give them their training, we actually have different areas that they can volunteer in. So, for instance, Jen was involved in sheltering. So she has had, as well as, you know, just like our other responders, she's had some shelter training, and there are things that they can do to hone their skills in sheltering, teach them how to deal with clients, you know, who have been displaced and are dealing with that emotional unrest, if you will, and help them work through some of that trauma. And Jim, during Sandy, he went down as part of the feeding team. You know, he went down with a mobile feeding vehicle with a crew member, with a teammate. And so they were, you know, providing meals out of the vehicle. We provide the training to get them ready for that type of situation so they know what they're doing. And so our volunteers, when they respond to an event, they have that background training to guide them on that path. You know, regardless of what the activity is, they've received that training to help get them through that. And, of course, they're always working with the rest of their team. So, you know, they've got that built-in support system on the ground.
I'm picturing the training happening, though, when everything's calm and nice and you don't have that fear around you. How much does it change when the reality is upon you? Or is the training that effective?
Training in what we now term blue sky, you know, when things are calm. Mm,
that's a good term.
That's certainly not trial by fire. And, you know, it looks very different once you get on the ground and people are actually, you know, knocking on the door and needing a place to stay and needing help or needing to talk to someone about, you know, medications or where am I going to sleep. You know, it's very different. And you know, we try to do exercises to kind of expose our volunteers to some of that. But again, it never substitutes for the real thing. And so we also rely very heavily on is our leadership that's on the ground, the people who have been out multiple times that know what the volunteers are dealing with so they can be there to lead their team, you know, whether it's a small team of three or the bigger, you know, the whole operation. And we count on our leadership to bring those calm, even-keeled skills to bear to kind of help muddle through.
But I think that training, at least for me, that I had here in Kansas City for a good solid year and a half was a real backbone for me when I was there, even though it could be very chaotic. And you're at registration, you know how to do registration, but now you have three busloads of people coming in from a destroyed area. But that's what actually helped me stay on task, was I knew exactly how to do it. But, you know, the human element part, that's you just kind of sometimes just take that as it comes. And but you got to have that training for the backbone.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, when we're kids and we all did the fire drills and everything in school and when we teach disaster plans, all that, you know, we always tell people practice, practice, practice. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we have to do when we're at home, you know, during calm times is, you know, we have to practice. We have to train so that, like you said, the background stuff is there. It's just a matter of, you know, your mind can kind of process all of that without even having to think about it. You know what you're doing. And so you're going through the registration process. You're going through the vehicle maintenance or the checklist. And, you know, the human element, you know, your consciousness can deal with that. Your subconscious is dealing with the technical side of it. So that does help.
But so often the infrastructure isn't what it would be in that blue sky situation either. I mean, I assume supply lines and so forth are compromised.
I think that was probably one of the big issues with Sandy is that the highway system, the street system, everything was in flux. And getting just simple gasoline for the vehicles and being able to respond to the areas that we needed to go to was a big issue at Sandy. Sandy was in an immense storm. I think it was far beyond what anybody dreamt it was going to be. Mm-hmm. Being able to feed the people, I was at a fixed site in Seaford, Long Island. It was one of those things where it was so immense, the training just kicked in, and I think we didn't have to think about all the things that were going on around us. We just fell into what we were trained to do and got the job done.
Did you see a lot of humanity at its best, worst? What do you feel like in that situation people are like?
Yes. I think we see all sides of it. For the most part, I think we see it at its best. Most of the people that are affected, the clients that we serve, many of them are sharing what they get from us with other people. It's not like a hoarding situation where they're getting as much as they possibly can. They're sharing whatever we can give to them, too. It's one of the better things that you see in the disaster is the caring and the help that everybody gives each other.
I noticed that too, actually, Randy. One of the things that really stunned me when I was there for 3 weeks was the response of the community. Every single day, because we had, I think, almost 1,000 people at any given time at Nassau Community College, just carloads of people would come in and say, what do you need? You know, what can we get? What can we do? And so I would specifically give them lists like, we need deodorant, we need toothpaste, we need towels, we need all the baby food. And I would just give them the list and they'd come back with these carloads of donations and just, what else can we do? What else can we do? And that was every single day. And that was very heartwarming.
Yeah, it is. It is really neat when you see that. Saw that when I was my very first disaster was in 2004. I went to Florida for Hurricane Charley, and you know, I did client casework back then, and we did it, you know, door to door, literally knocking, going door to door in some of these very hard hit areas, and we were doing casework. You know, sitting on the side of the street, sitting in the car, you know, just wherever we could actually sit down with our laptops and do casework, but. I can remember there was this one lady, and she was so sweet. We were in a mobile home park. It was a retirement village. And every single stop I made with my partner, she would pop her head in, and she was, you know, going door to door reminding all of the residents, don't forget our neighborhood meeting tonight, Sweetest face. Yeah, and she was just like this glowing smile and just little bitty thing. And I kept thinking, I want to be like her, you know, just I just kept thinking, what a ray of sunshine. Mm-hmm. And we were just about done with the day. My partner was, you know, we were both exhausted. It was, you know, over 100 degrees out that day. And, you know, he'd gone out to move the vehicle and he came back. And I said, you know, I said, we need to call it a day. We'll finish up our casework tomorrow. And he just looked at me and said, no, I said, you remember the little lady we've been seeing? And I said, yeah. And he looked at me, and goes, she's our last house. I was like, then we're finishing up today. And so, you know, we were able to finish our day with that lady. And she was so sweet and so caring about her neighbors. Mm-hmm. And yet her home was being demolished. You know, it was being hauled off that day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just seeing her on the street, you'd have never known it. I mean, she was – because she was worried about her neighbors. Yeah. And I just – you know, I carry that with me every time I go out, you know, just knowing that, you know, we're seeing something phenomenal every time we go out. We're seeing – how people band together, you know, like Jen said, the community just, they rally. And it's, to me, it's an amazing thing to be a part of.
Yeah, I'm guessing some of our listeners may have experienced similar things. And, of course, we invite you to join the conversation if you've maybe been to a similar situation, have a memory you'd like to share. We're here at 816-235-2888. We are up to date here. I'm Randy Mason filling in for Steve Kraske. It's great to hear stories about the human condition as you know, reported from people on the front line. So, again, if you have something to share, we'd love to hear from you. 816-235-2888. I'm wondering, does a hurricane versus a tornado versus a flood dictate a lot of what you guys are required to do? Do the different types of disasters bring out a sudden, you know, shift in what needs to occur?
When Red Cross responds to any event, you know, we have five initial actions that we focus on. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, providing safe shelter for those who've been displaced, providing food for those who've been displaced and possibly even first responders, providing, you know, obtaining and providing damage assessment information, because we have to gather the information on how big and how bad it was. I just got stuck, Jen. Shelter, feeding, disaster assessment information, public affairs, you know, sharing information about our story, what we're doing, and then making sure we have representation in our emergency operations centers, working with our government partners. But the first two, sheltering and feeding, you know, that we have to meet those basic human needs. And so regardless of whether it's a hurricane, a tornado, a wildfire, you know, that is going to be our first concern, is making sure people have that safe haven, that safe place to sleep, way to feed their family, you know, making sure everyone is cared for. How we do it might look a little different. Where we do it might look a little different, but what we do will always be the same.
And the urgency of that call, I guess, sometimes, too, how much warning you might have, in some cases, a little bit more head start on it, I suspect, than a tornado that strikes really almost instantly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because for Sandy, we were able to pre-deploy it ahead of the storm and sort of anticipate where it might hit. This is why we chose where we chose to set up mm-hmm. those shelters, which are already designated. But it can also change very suddenly. We actually had quite a few people in Long Island who were staying in their homes after the storm. The homes weren't destroyed, but they had no electricity. Then we had a snowstorm halfway through the first week. All those people that were trying to make it in their homes without heat then ended up coming to the shelter. So, and a lot of them couldn't get here, so we had National Guard helping with transportation and buses and everything. So it can change pretty quickly, but as Joanne said, our role pretty much stays the same. Give them a warm bed, blankets, food, a nurse if they need it, you know, and a safe place.
Well, part of the reason I ask about the urgency is, excuse me, that notion that you all have other things you might be doing or places you might be. how hard is it to suddenly be called upon to get to place B? The time frame could I think disrupt a schedule pretty well.
It can, and you know, we ask our volunteers to kind of look at their schedules, you know, for blocks of time, and they make themselves available. We do have an electronic system, if you will, that we use to recruit and deploy our responders. And so it's really amazing how quickly the organization can actually mobilize. You know, whether it's pre-deployment, I can't even remember how many people we had pre-deployed in areas that might have that were under the gun, so to speak, you know, for Sandy. Hmm. And you know, we had supplies, we had vehicles, we had people. You know, we had a lot of this stuff pre-staged. We had to relocate some of it, you know, once the storm came through, but you know, we were in a much better position. But you know, when you look at close to 600 chapters across the United States, you know, it's not hard to mobilize people. And our volunteers are phenomenal. They are ready to go, you know, and especially if they know something's getting ready to happen, like the hurricanes, or, you know, as soon as they see something on the news, you know, it's, you know, I'm ready to go. And, you know, of course, none of us can do it without the support of our families and our friends back home either.
What do you have to have on hand when that call comes? Some things that you may have learned, I better take that with me.
In the case of Sandy, we saw the storm building for the week prior to being deployed. And being on the calendar, so to speak, we knew that we were going to be deployed. When we get the phone call, they tell us, hey, how soon can you be to the chapter? We're taking off with the emergency response vehicle. I think I had 4 hours notice. But you know what you need to take. You can take the basics, essentially. There's a possibility of not having electricity. There's a possibility of not having heat. In the case of Sandy, we were up there in the latter part of October. You don't think you're going to have you definitely don't think you're going to go through a nor'easter a week into it and wake up with 6 inches of snow on the ground and you're up there with nothing but shorts. Mm-hmm. But you get through it. And so you prepare. Having been through several DRs, the disaster reliefs, I knew what to take. You take a sleeping bag. You take a mat. A foam mat to sleep on because you don't know where you're going to be sleeping. You could be sleeping in the emergency response vehicle if you get stuck somewhere because you never know exactly where you're going to end up. Most of the time we end up in a staff shelter, which is just like the client shelter. You're on a cot 18, 20 inches from the next person over, and it's a big family.
And apparently it makes you want to come back for more.
It really does. You know, there's really something to be said for the whole effort. You know, when you get a lot of people working together for a common goal, which is taking care of a community that's been affected so tragically, you know, we're all focused on the same thing, and we're all away from our families. We're all away from our normal support system. So we become that for each other.
Yeah.
And you don't have the luxury of it taking 6 months to make a new friend. I mean, you bond like within hours. And
minutes.
It's like, you're my new friend. Yeah, minutes sometimes. And so it is amazing. It's an amazing feeling when you're a part of something that phenomenal.
It's true. Actually, a lot of us stayed in the same staff shelter, which is a church not that far from the community college. And one of the best parts of the day was at the end of the day, I'd go back to the staff shelter, and there was the pastor there, and he'd give every one of us a hug at the end of the day. It was so a great thing to look forward to at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It seems that like a lot of type A personalities, though, might be involved in something like this. And getting them all to march in the same direction, even if their families, even as much as we love each other, aren't always, you know, able to mesh perfectly.
Yeah. You know, it can be a challenge, but again, we fall back on our training. You know, the mission of the organization drives us and helps provide us a lot of that. Our fundamental principles tell us, you know, provide us that guidance on how we're going to walk down that path. But our training and understanding that our goal, you know, our service delivery isn't about, you know, me and what part I specifically play. It's me being a part of the team and what is my team trying to accomplish
right.
And move the team forward. Is it always smooth? No. You know, it is a disaster. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time for that team to gel and for everyone to get into step. But, you know, again, we're so focused on what is the end result. And I think as long as volunteers, you know, when they've got that in the back of their mind, you know, I'm not here for me. I'm not here for, you know, this or that. I'm here to take care of people. And it's like, okay, fine. Then that's the way we're going to do it.
Yeah, I don't think we're out there for the personal rewards. It's the reward of giving the clients what they need, fulfilling their needs, their immediate needs, which could be anything from sheltering to food to bottled water, or just giving them a hug that they definitely sometimes need.
Does having that Red Cross emblem make people immediately react? Is there that identity, that brand?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's, you know, 130 years behind that symbol. Mm-hmm. And anywhere you go, you know, especially after a disaster, whether it's a house fire locally or, you know, something as large as Sandy or, you know, any of the other disasters, the symbol of the American Red Cross is typically, received as that symbol of hope. You know, they know that help is right behind that symbol. And they may not remember any of our faces. There are days I certainly hope they didn't. But they do know that the Red Cross was there. And they remember seeing the Red Cross on the vehicle. They remember seeing the Red Cross on the jackets or the vests, you know. And so I think that, the emblem carries a lot of weight.
Yeah, when you pull into an affected area, you definitely draw a crowd. So.
And yeah. I don't think, remember at the shelter? The staff shelter we all stayed at, a lot of our IRV crews, our response vehicle crews, were staying in that shelter. And I think at one time there were like 15, 20 vehicles that they would park side by side. And there was something so heart lifting, you know, pulling into the parking lot and seeing all of those vehicles lined up. I mean,
help is here.
Yeah.
Help
it was here. Just, you know, I would send pictures, you know, back to my friends, and I'm like, you know, this is the best part of my day, you know, seeing that and knowing that those trucks have been out there providing food.
And some of these people really probably do make an impression on you, whether they individually remember your name. I'm guessing some of those faces are linked. And Jen, you had an experience?
Yes, I did actually. I was there the first week, so there were still a lot of people that were missing loved ones. They weren't sure where they were, and an older woman came in on a walker, and she was distraught, and she said, I can't find my husband. And so I said, well, let's sit over here, let's try to find him, we'll call the other shelters, et cetera. And she was so upset, and I tried calling various shelters, but it's so hard to find anyone in that kind of chaos. And I was talking to another shelter, and I heard her yell, and I turned around, and her husband was coming through the door. And he also was on a walker, and it was like the two of them were heading to each other, like very slowly, and the whole lobby filled up. We had FEMA guys there. We had National Guard guys there. Everybody was crying. Everybody was crying, and they finally got together and hugged each other, and they were crying. And that was one of the most memorable things I've ever experienced in my life. So that was a great one. There's certainly stories where people came in and they knew their loved ones were gone. But, you know, we just, you know, to have stories like that, that's something I will always take with me.
That was a very cinematic moment you just described there. That was pretty good stuff.
I'm tearing up right now.
I know. Stop.
Yeah. Well, a volunteer knows they're in for both some of those tough moments and probably some rewards. When you search for volunteers, do you look for backgrounds, just military help, certain trainings that are already in existence, or do you start almost with blank slate?
Well, of course, a lot of that depends on, you know, what the need is that we're trying to fill in our volunteer pool. Certainly, you know, there's a niche for everybody. In the Red Cross. You know, there are so many different things you can do in disaster response, whether it's out on the front lines, you know, working in a shelter or driving one of the feeding trucks or sitting in an emergency operations center. You know, there's things you can do back office, you know, sitting, you know, helping out with staff services or computer work, that sort of thing. So there's a wide range of skills. You know, a lot of it depends on exactly what area we're looking at.
I'm just picturing that, having to sleep on cots and all those things, which maybe certain backgrounds prepare you more for. Or is it just I come in and suddenly that makes all the sense in the world no matter what my background?
We look for flexibility. the ability to just kind of, you know, go with the flow and to not take things personally, just understand that we're dealing with individuals on their worst day, and to be able to keep that in mind and just kind of let that roll and to keep the mission in front. We look for volunteers that have a strong sense of adventure would be a good one. Because every disaster is going to be different. And so, you know, being able to just say, okay, so this is where we're going this time. This is what we're going to work on. You know, but it's, like I said, a lot of times you start out doing one job and you find out that maybe this is a better path for me. You know, I started out doing client casework. And I miss talking with clients when I'm out on a disaster, but doing government liaison work is very rewarding to me. And so, you know, that's kind of my new niche.
And the organization allows that to happen?
There's movement
within?
Very open to you moving into any field that you want to go into. A lot of people probably wouldn't be able to mentally keep up with the pace of the disasters. It's not the easiest thing in the world to go out there and walk into these disasters where everything is gone. It does take a sense of humor sometimes. People are, like I said, sometimes these people are at their very best, even when the disaster, when they've lost everything. So it is a good idea that you can go in and try different things, and if it doesn't work out, there's always a different avenue you can go down in the Red Cross.
I think that's one of the things we really focus on, too, at the Red Cross is cross-training, so that if I'm on a disaster and I need to take the IRV out and do mobile feeding, I can do it. If I need to be in registration, they can send me there. If I need to do feeding, I can go over there. Whatever the role is, we try to be able to fit into it as needed. And I like that personally because I get to experience all those different ways of, you know, helping.
And that sense of adventure, it's very much still part of it for you?
It is for me. I mean, I'm just an adventurous soul as it is. But so maybe it is. I did kind of feel like I was with my people when I was in the staff shelter because they all do have this sort of zest for life. But also they really care about humanity and people suffering. And so I love that combination of a person, you know, and I want to be around people like that. So.
It sounds like you found a good place to be, and I think sharing it with people just reminds them that there will be another disaster coming. I mean, we consider it today, and everything's great, but it could be as soon as 6 hours from now. You're on your way to somewhere. That must make your life a little bit hard to predict.
It can. But again, you know, I know for me, my husband is very supportive of what I do, and he loves. Loves it when I can go out and do that because he knows how much it means to me. And, you know, my kids are grown, but, you know, I like being able to set that example for my grown kids and for my grandkids. You know, being able to set that example of being able to go out and help people. You know, my oldest granddaughter has actually gone up to the Red Cross office with me a few times when I've gone up to do paperwork. And that's what she calls it. You know, that's Grandma's Red Cross office. And she likes to meet my Red Cross friends. So, you know, I like instilling some of that.
I don't think we could do it if we didn't have the support of our families. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable to get a phone call and 2 hours later be on the road to somewhere.
Yeah.
And not have the support of your family. So it's extremely important. They're probably stronger than we are, quite honestly.
And not to mention dealing with us when we come home.
That's true.
Take a while.
Yeah, my husband is very, very supportive. He, like Joanne's husband, is just he's so proud that one of us can go at least do it. I mean, he always feels like, you know, when he retires, he wants to be able to work with the Red Cross too. But he knows how important it is to me to be able to do it. And that's one of the things too. I realized, I mean, I worked at at Cerner for about 10 years before I quit to write a novel I've been working on. So I actually have the luxury to be able to go out for 3 weeks at a time. But one thing I did notice, there are so many retired couples that go out and deploy together, and it's so great to see that because I always tell my husband, now, when we retire, we're going to do that too. It's like, okay.
Yeah. The good stories, good chance to really review people out there on the front lines, helping helping the country, helping communities. And we want to thank Joanne Woody, Jen Farmer, Jim Petish from the Red Cross for joining us today on Up to Date.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.